want to just give you two examples of a group of Africans singing before they start drumming, because it's always done. They just have a sort of long series of singing period, and then after that we come in with the drums, because I want you to get used to the kind of mood which is created. And two, play you a short bit by a young African composer who is using the themes suggested by the drums in composing new music as an expression of the old in our own time.
Is coming on. That is the same. That is also by the same composer. It's written for flute, oboe, and piano. And the part which is coming on.
Who's the composer?
Nketiah. Yes, you knew him. He was with you at the place, Margaret Gate.
Thank you.
kind of idea what's happening. I want to put on two pieces for you to see. One, music from Guinea, and then I put on a short piece to show you what I meant about dancing to certain rhythms, and I hope you'll be able to do it.
Okay. pass on now to the next panelist. Mr. Ofiano, would you care to speak now?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Ladies and gentlemen, I apologize for having come late, but I had to be somewhere until 1 o'clock, and then I hope I'm not going to interfere with you if I say I'm going to leave early again because I have to get somewhere else. I think Mr. Opoku has given us quite a platform from which to start. I'm not going to explain to you what goes on in Africa. I think even if you are not aware of it, you have learned that it is too complicated for words to explain. Now I'm going to offer you a challenge in our schools today. We've come to realize that the world of nationalism is gone. And yet, in Africa, we have these new nations coming up or being born practically every other day, and we start teaching nationalism. And what sort of nationalism do we have to teach our children? Well, to me, as far as I'm concerned, I say that we teach them a kind of nationalism which fits together with internationalism, because the world has really become one. And this is where we cannot risk to fail to understand peoples of other cultures. We must not try to think of ourselves forming a complete unity, but we have to think that we form only a part of mankind. So when we visit schools or we mix with the Americans and they start asking us questions, sometimes we think that some of the questions we are asked are very naive. It's more true with adults than with young children. And this is something I have said, and I'm saying it again. I don't think I have any fear of saying it, and I'll repeat it again. Because the adults think that if you don't speak the same language or you don't understand the language people speak in this country, then either you are not educated or you are not a fully developed human being or you are a strange creature. And this kind of thing is what we have to fight with our children from the very youth, that we adults, we don't pass it on to the children, but we allow them to live in the world they are going to live in future, to learn to live. Because the world the children are going to live in future is very, very different from the world we are living in. And this is where education becomes very important. There are so many means which are now being used in education, and I better mention the one which we should fight against. And as educators, we should not fight against it by destroying it, but by producing something better, and that's films, which are being constantly used. And you see these not only in the theaters or the movie houses, but in the television. And books. Books which were written a few years ago, which are being used in schools now, are going and are being revised. The United Nations has a special branch which is doing everything possible to standardize textbooks so that when you learn about other people's cultures, you don't learn that the Chinese they eat rice with the sticks instead of using knives and forks, or the Africans eat with their fingers, as somebody and the Europeans use knives and forks. Well, the most sensible answer I got from somebody one day told the other person who was asking, why do you use your fingers and not knives and forks? He said, look, the knives and forks you use have been into so many mouths that I cannot count how many, whereas the hands and fingers I used are only my own and they touch my food and my mouth only. So here we are, you can get these things going backwards and forwards. So our aim in education should not be to criticize what the other people are doing, criticize in the destructive sense, but to try to assimilate, to try to see why they are living like that, and what makes them live that way. And I believe this should be the core of trying to teach international understanding or intercultural understanding. In passing, I should mention to you here that most of you probably have read that book, Something of Value, have you? Or saw the movie? If you didn't, then you didn't miss anything. In fact, you're proud of yourself. because Mr. Poku told you something which I thought was very appropriate, that we should try to eradicate the concept of what things should be like. The American public is being brought up, is being pressured, is being geared to buy only what the sellers want them to buy. This is something which I think we have to fight against, to free ourselves, so that you don't go to buy a book because it has been written for you to read, but because there's a material which you want for your own personal learning. And this Robert Ruach went to Kenya and brought to the Americans what the Americans wanted to hear at that time, and he wrote and he made millions, and he turned it to his second book, Poor No More. Now, these are the things, you see, which are very damaging when we are talking about international relations, or you go to a school where the teacher, in trying to relate the cultures of other peoples, instead of seeing the reasons why, as we have been told here about these dances and the language and so on, they say people who are, what should I call, I don't like the word, but if you can think the word, a better word, I call them a primitive. Now that word primitive in this country I think is also much more confused than in any other English speaking world, because when you go to a place where they talk of primitive art or primitive dances is something which is considered, I think, culturally, something of a higher level culturally, whereas if you refer to a person as primitive, then you are looking down upon him. And then in mathematics we have primitive circles to begin with and all the rest of it. So people, when you think of other people who may not be wearing the same dresses as you do, speak the same language as you speak, have manners which are very different from yours, don't look at them as strange people, because we are even stranger to one another among ourselves, people of the same culture, than we are to foreigners. In other words, an American, I think it's more strange if he's still American than he is to an African or Chinese. Because when we come together, we, an African and American, we automatically accept that we are both different people. Therefore, we learn to accept each other's with whatever attitude we may be having. But there's something above that, which is something human. And this is a human level which you should be trying to elevate in our schools. And to elevate it through education, I think we should try to use education as a frontier. A frontier against fear, I think that's the best word to use. We are afraid of so many things. Ignorance, and we're now people fighting the Cold War and the Hot War and all the rest of it. And these are the things which we should try to understand each other. So ask ourselves the question, why do we fight anyway? A few people at the top come to disagreement for some other one reason or another. War is declared. Why? The following day, the enemies make alliances and they become allies, and then unite to fight somebody who was one of the party's allies in the former one. Why do we do these things? If we start going into the details, we find that it's not because of our differences, but because we are all striving to satisfy the things which we are all similar in needs. Our similarities bring greater conflict than our differences. And in intercultural relations, we have to go deeper into understanding our similarities rather than overemphasizing our differences. Education is not only knowing how to read and write. Mr. Poku was giving us a very good illustration of the people here asking him to give what the Americans want. I was being pressured one day in one of the cities outside New York City to have a sketch of mine written in the paper, but the editor wanted to write it in the way the readers would like it to be. And this I refused to resolve, that we came to complete disagreement. A thing was never printed. And I think I'm glad that I did that, because I stood for what is right. We should not go on emphasizing our differences or what the people want to hear about you, that your grandfather didn't know how to read and write. Maybe so, but he had greater wisdom, had greater understanding of affairs around him. His world might have been smaller than our own world now, but he understood that small world of his. It is now our duty to train ourselves to learn to understand this large world in which we live in, which has become so small that we don't know even where to go to next. We know very soon we are going to change so many things. Our old needs of food, shelter, and clothing have become, what shall I call them, luxury now. So we need greater frontiers to explore. Our needs now, I think, are based on what we want, which is health and social security, education, and another thing, which has been very well emphasized here, recreation, which I better add, Mr. Perkle, that it includes, recreation includes the art of doing nothing. Because you all know that the hours which people used to work is growing shorter and shorter. From 45, 50, or 60 hours a week, people are now getting to 40 hours a week, and many, many people are working 35 hours a week, and very soon we shall be going down to 30 hours a week. Now, if you work out 30 hours a week, instead of, if you're working 30 hours a week, instead of former 45 hours a week, what do you do with the other 15 hours a week which you have for spare? Do you just indulge into dream world, or you go and see anything for the sake of passing time, or do you go and have a purposeful recreation? And I think this is something which we really need to explore. Because the more free time we have, the greater the opportunity we have of learning of other people's cultures. Are we using that time for that kind of purpose, or are we using it for other things which do not elevate our thoughts, our convictions, our ideas, but only downgrade them? In education, for international understanding, we have to understand that we cannot do it from where we are alone. It's true that not all of us can travel. Some of us have been luckier than others. Some people do travel, and they deal and learn nothing. Others travel for a short while only and learn a great deal. So here again, I'm not going to propose that everybody takes a trip overseas, because what will be the use? The world now can be brought right to your doorstep, inside your bedroom, even through television. But the point is this, is what you see or read in books, a correct interpretation of what takes place overseas. Now here is a big challenge to parents and educators. How much can we pass to our children about the true picture, about the correct interpretation of things which take place abroad? Because you cannot bring understanding unless you have really got to know how to explain that kind of understanding to another person. If you are ignorant of something, you cannot explain it to another person. So we have to start with ourselves first, learn about ourselves, and then when we see other people, as I said before, we go and look for points of agreement. We go and look for the similarities, and we leave alone our differences. And then we find ourselves both sitting on the same side of the fence. Now, in this, we have to develop our minds to think in a certain way. We have to be physically fit so that we have clean minds. And we must have what I'm afraid is being lost very rapidly, a kind of spiritual conviction. There are certain things which go beyond words. And these are the things which are being expressed, some of them in the drums we heard today. There are things which cannot be explained by words. They go beyond. And unless we are prepared to listen to our inner selves and elevate this to something higher, we'll find ourselves always scratching the top of everything and leaving the fatness beneath it. We have to dig deep in all this search for understanding. In this international outlook, we cannot take a flight visit ask my friend Robert Rourke, write the book here, and then take a trip for a month. You come back after a month, the book is out. Of course, we start wondering, what did he learn in a month about the people of other cultures? But there are people with who know, people with techniques, people who understand certain things, that they may go abroad for one particular purpose. And these people are usually very cautious to express categorical views, because they say, this is what I know, this is what I saw, and this is what I believe in now. But should something come up, I'll change my view. A very good example, as they say, is our friend John Gunther. He's changing fairly fast. And this shows a kind of understanding. He's now trying to understand human nature and brings something different, because he's realizing that probably at one time he gave too much of what people wanted to read and forgot to give the correct thing. Had he started it before, then he wouldn't be having so much trouble now in reconstructing these things. But that was the way of life which is past. We can now look back to it. And of course, you know, there's nothing which can be harsher than a person who has learned something and now is giving what we may refer to as the hindsight, the things which are past. They say, why did that thing happen at that time? Not knowing how much problem that fellow had to face at that time and what people understood at that time. So the trouble is neither in the past nor in the future, but it is the present. The present we live in is what builds the future as the product of the past. And if we look both ways, then we'll see where we are going. But if we just decide to remain stationary or look forward and forget the past, we will not know where we are going to. And if we look at the past only, without looking at the front, we won't know where we are heading to. And so, as cultures change, people change. And what you may tell a child now may be obsolete tomorrow, that you be prepared to revise your views tomorrow, because you say, that's what we said because that's what we knew yesterday, but more knowledge has come in today, and this is what we need now. I believe that from here, after this afternoon, most of us will have reformed their views about many things. And also most of us will go away saying, after all, we are all the same human beings all over the world. It's true. But how is a child to be brought to know this? I found it very difficult to come and take part in this because of one thing. When we talk of these things, somebody thinks, well, he's saying it because he's from such and such a country, or he's saying it because he doesn't understand us America, or this person is not trying to learn our ways, he's too much sticking to his own ways, or he's leaving his ways and trying to absorb everything in us. We have to select all these things and learn to face the truth. If you are American and you go overseas and you are asked a question, what happens in such and such a place? We used to talk of Little Rock. Now you may be asked, what is going on in New Orleans? Well, the best thing, the best answer to give is that probably it is not what is there, but our way of life, which you have to understand. And understanding a way of life will make this person try to sort out the kind of people who go the one way or another way. In other words, you will be trying to inculcate the similarities which you have with this person overseas than trying to emphasize points of differences. You say, you see, you people, you do this and that, we do it this way. You do this and that, we do it the other way. This is the kind of thing which I hope was brought up last night, I'm not sure. But I noticed in the program you had something about this Operation Crossroads in Africa. Before the people left last summer, I had opportunity of talking to them, so I told them, look, whenever you get to Africa, I do not go and look for points of differences, but go and look for points of similarities. And as they were all people from school and going to meet those people who are coming from school, I told them, don't you go and start discussing this American system of education and comparing it with the system of education in Ghana or Sierra Leone or Gambia or wherever they were going, but try to assimilate as much as possible. While we are looking for these things which make us differ, we are losing so much time. And this is where we, I think, in this present world, we are facing a great deal of a crisis because of trying to find where the Americans are different from the Russians. And therefore, the American way of life has to be protected this way, and the Russian way of life be protected another way. We know that the Russian child is just as much as valuable to her mother or her parents as much as an American child. And when we look at these things this way, I think we open wider horizons in our educational system. I only hope that a program like this one here is a great eye-opener. We go to it, we learn something new. And in so learning, we hope that books will follow to keep the children informed. And we are looking forward to the time when the educators will have more programs on the television and these fight promoters.
Now, Mrs. Dudley Moore will tell us something of the work of the Unitarian Service Committee in its project in community work in Nigeria.
I feel almost apologetic because I have already gotten so much from the two previous speakers that perhaps my real reason for speaking to you at all is the fact that so much has been said and written at various times about the ineptness with which Americans work abroad, that I might give you some examples of, humble though they are, of the way of working of one agency, working in depth in one village. I'm not an expert on Africa, but I feel, and I have written no books on Africa, nor do I ever expect to have time to write a book on Africa. But I have spent a great deal of the last 18 months in working in this one village, in trying to orient other Americans who were going to this village to work, in explaining why some Americans we sent did what they did, and to try to find this common meeting ground that I think is so important. To begin with, and I can only speak for myself and therefore for my agency, communication is a subtle thing, and I am so grateful to Mr. Opoku for what he said, because I think that we're the greatest nation of verbalizers that I have ever been exposed to. This does not mean that that Nigerians, and this is particularly true of Igbos, I think, don't like to talk. They love to talk. And it is also true of Navajo people with whom I've worked that they feel, but there are occasions when they love to get up and make speeches, and rather long ones. But the fact is that some of the most important communications in life are not done with words or with words alone. And this is very hard for some American trained professional people to understand, because, and it is one of the things that we have to do in orienting. We feel compelled to tell other people what we know, even though it's inappropriate. And so you can see why an agency such as ours has difficulty in the selection, in the orienting of staff. you were talking, Mr. Okofu, of art, but let us include, and I'm sure you would, human relations also in this, because the art of human relationships is something that we have to develop. And so let me just give you a few examples, good or bad. This compelling of the compulsion that people feel under. This is not about a staff person of the Unitarian Service Committee, so I can be very glib about telling it. An American engineer was in Africa to consult with a group of chiefs about some engineering system. And this first meeting was taking place in a house that had a straw thatched roof and a central fire, and there was some smoke in the air, and this man was not accustomed to it, and he coughed and he blew his nose, and all of a sudden in the middle of this conference he stopped and he said, "You know, I could show your people how to build a fireplace over in that corner, and it would take all the smoke right out of the air, and then we would have no further trouble. And this is cheap because you can build it of your soil." And the chief said, "My son, if it were not for the smoke, we would have no roof over our heads. The insects would eat the roof. Let us get on with our engineering problem." This is a true story told by a technical assistance person who was not afraid to tell the bad with the good. On the other hand, we believe very firmly that you cannot separate the process or the words teaching and learning, that they're all part of one. And so when our first nutritionist went to our mama at the request of the people themselves, because they said, "We want to make our children healthier, help us." And only then did the nutritionist go. And by the way, when I went for my second longer visit and met someone I had not met before, the chief said, "Is this another cook?" Because our nutritionist, first of all, went with some of the leaders of the kindred groups and observed food preparation, learn the Igbo names of the foods that are used, found out what was on sale in the market and how much it cost to buy this, and what the eating habits were when the cooking was done, what the cultural patterns are, and only after this process did she, even in our own compound, begin to ask, "Does anyone use this and this leaf? Because this would make better blood. This would provide iron." She found out, for example, that peanuts were, at that time, roasted peanuts, ground nuts, were considered the kind of luxury that you buy as a snack for your children. But if enough women asked the market men, the middlemen, the traders and the middlemen, for raw ground nuts, they can buy them very cheaply in quantity and learn to roast them in hot sand. And then by leaving the skins on as they shell them and crushing them and putting them into soup, they are getting the cheapest kind of protein, and they are building better bodies in an area where there is almost no animal protein. I won't go into all the reasons why. But this took months before she got to this. Now again, it wasn't by talking. When she was finally invited to share this knowledge that she had, she did cooking, not on a kerosene stove, but with the way the women cook, on an iron ring. And then she had with her enough dishes and enough spoons to share what she had cooked with everyone so they would all have a taste, even the men. And the men were included in this, because how can you improve the total family diet if you don't include all the people? Now, one of the things that is happening as a new development is the fact that while we as an agency were not involved with the building of the community grammar school, which is not a missionary school, built by the people with their own hands and their own money, they have their own board. This is an innovation, for there are girls in this school as well as boys. This is the English system, you know, comparable to our high school. But we acknowledge from the beginning that there are two areas in which people change less readily. People will adopt one another's clothes patterns. They will adopt one another's hairdos. They will adopt one another's dances. But there are two areas which the anthropologist can explain to us in which we change most slowly. And one of them is in our food habits. And so I never have been able to trace who, said that if you want to teach a man to change his habits of eating, you have to start with his grandmother. And we feel, therefore, that it is not enough. Just think back about your own mothers, as I think about my mother once in a while and the way she prepares food. It is not enough to teach these women with small children to have these extension courses. We are now working through this grammar school. We use chemistry. We teach what they have to know to pass examinations. But we are going beyond that, and we are teaching the chemistry of foods. We are teaching about the human body and what the human body needs. And we are teaching this to boys and girls who will be fathers and mothers. And then we are saying, this is what we can teach the women and the men in your village, or this is what we are teaching to your kindred. And go home, when you go home, talk to your parents about this, because we happen to think that there's another element in this, and that is, we've done this with Navajo Indians, that as an agency, we feel that we must constantly build this bridge between generations so that these people who are at home will feel more close to their young people who are being educated. And this, again, is a different kind of communication. We are planning to do the same thing in health, in sanitation, in nutrition. This is very slow. This does not happen fast. We are not an agency that pours vast sums of money into a program. Perhaps again, as I said in the beginning, my only reason for being here is that there is an agency which represents this quality that you spoke of, that is working in depth in one village from which others can learn, where we are sharing what we know and have and are learning at the same time these very subtle relationships which African people or people in any other place can teach us.
Esther Walls.
Well, I'd like to say, first of all, that I'm not an expert on Africa at all, and I assume that the reason I'm on this panel is because I took a trip to Africa in 1959, and because as a librarian, I have been drawing up some bibliographies on Africa to be used by young adults and children. I would like to say just a word about the trip. I think that in some ways, going to West Africa was the culmination of a lifetime dream. I had always wanted to go, and I, number one, knew that my own slave ancestors had come from West Africa. And I suppose it's a matter of natural curiosity to know where your ancestors come from and what they're like, et cetera. And also, there had been so many contradictions in my own reading and feelings about Africa. At one time, you would read books which would indicate that the Africans had absolutely no culture whatsoever, they're semi-literate, no past history. And at the same time, my own contacts with bright young students here in New York City and diplomats at the UN led me to believe that there was a lot that wasn't being said. So I decided that I would take off for Africa and decide myself exactly find out myself what I could expect. So one day in June of 1959, I took off with a canvas suitcase and a box of malaria pills and a camera. And I was a little apprehensive because my friends had all given me such strange advice. My own doctor said that I should take some high hip boots and wear them at all times, also wear slacks and sweaters in the evening in order to avoid the terrible bite of the malaria mosquito. One of my friends who had been to Africa said to take no nylon because it would be terribly hot. And yet, I might add, it was the coolest summer I ever spent. And thinking of New York summers, it was just fantastic. It was nice and cool because I was there during the rainy season. I was advised that I might probably would get black water fever, et cetera. So one friend said, you'll sit in your hotel room for weeks and no one will approach you. You'll be terribly lonely, et cetera. So it's no wonder that I was a little frightened as I took off on the Pan American plane, and I didn't like the idea of flying 19 hours over the Atlantic and the Sahara Desert either. But when I landed in Accra, all of my fears suddenly dissipated. I got a cab and started off toward my hotel. I'm sure the cab driver thought I was crazy. I was oohing and aahing at the sights along the streets. I think the thing that impressed me the most was the color. Everybody wearing lovely bright colors and women with calabashes on their heads, etc. And also the contrast in the brand new, lovely modern buildings built with the latest architectural design and the contrast with the things that were old and all. But I finally drove up to my hotel and I was a little disappointed. I had been told that there were about four hotels in Accra that I could choose from. One was the Ambassador Hotel, which is beautiful and as commodious and wonderful as any hotel in a large city in Europe or in America. But it was air conditioned, but it had air conditioned prices too. So I decided I would try the second best, and I tried. I had made reservations for a little hotel called the Avenida Hotel, which was more like a Spanish inn. When I got there, the bellboy showed me up to my room, and it was a very tiny room with a wooden wardrobe, three hangers in the closet, and there was this strange funereal shroud hanging from the ceiling and sort of tucked underneath the bed. This is my first vision of a mosquito net. And I was really quite disappointed. I thought I would hate staying there, but I came to love this place. And I might add, just to show you how things are changing so dynamically and so quickly, right while I was there, they broke down the old walls. And this is my first hearing of African drums. The workmen didn't work as our American workmen did, but they did everything rhythmically. You would hear a sound off in this side of the building and then someone responding on the other side in the drum fashion. And the whole entire hotel was rehabilitated while I was there, and they now charge air-conditioned prices too. If I were to highlight some of the most exciting things that happened to me, I would say that an interview that I had with the Prime Minister was terribly exciting. I was very thrilled with that. I also had a chance to go off into the interior and to visit some rural small villages. I spent one morning dancing with a group of women for about 4 hours and trying to learn how to do some of these ethnic dances. And I might add that I began to feel that there is a kinship between American Negroes and Africans because I didn't have too much difficulty at all. I also went off with an archaeologist one day and watched him set up an excavation where they hoped to unearth Stone Age implements. And for me, the entire trip intensified any interest that I had in biology or in science, in music and the dance or whatever. So what I advise any, even though you can bring Africa into your home with a television set, I would advise anybody who can go to Africa by all means to go and see for yourself. I think I'm supposed to be talking to you mostly about books for Africa, and I think that those of us who work with children and young adults have been extremely happy to realize that there have been some significant changes in book publication, books that are published about Africa. For a long, long time, the only picture we had of Africa was one which was given to us by the big game hunters and the missionaries. This was the world of Osa and Martin Johnson and Dr. Livingston, etc. So it's no wonder that our American youngsters and adults, as far as that's concerned, have a rather one-sided view of Africa. I think recently there have been some changes, and they're due probably in part to the fact that we are growing away from the kind of provincialism we used to know, where you looked at other cultures as exotic, but you didn't really think in terms of the people. And I think that the activities of the United Nations, and it's the fact that the United Nations is here in New York, or in the United States, has had a lot to do with our changing attitudes. But whatever the changes are caused by, we're glad to see them reflected in the literature that's being written about Africa. I would say that if I were going to set up standards for a selection of books about Africa, I would say that the book that you consider the first is the book that's written by the African, because this is the book that will give you a more honest reflection of the people's goals and the things that they want in life, etc. I would suggest that you read The Dark Child by Camera Lai, if you haven't read that one, because this is a wonderful, evocative, poetic story of a man from Guinea growing up, and he talks about his childhood there. He makes us understand a lot about the universal qualities in growing up, and yet it has a cultural stamp that gives you a real idea about growing up in a small African village. So the matter of authorship is very important. If you can't find books that are written by Africans, I would suggest that you consider the author very carefully. I think the reader now has a right to expect that the author know something about comparative cultures, know something about comparative religions, and that the author at least be sympathetically involved with the people about whom he is writing. And this doesn't mean that he has to suspend all of his critical judgment in order to do so. But we have so many books written by people who went to Africa. In fact, people said to me, are you going to write a book about Africa after I'd been there for 2 months? I don't feel that I can write a book about Africa that means anything, because it wouldn't have any depth of characterization. It wouldn't have any real knowledge, and it wouldn't be authentic. Wouldn't have any authority behind it either. So I feel that the books that we have to accept that are written by people other than Africans should be examined very carefully to make sure that the person knows what he's talking about. And the third thing that I would consider as an important criteria would be that the book be well written. All of us like to read books that have some literary merit. We like to recommend books that have literary merits too. So those are the standards that I would apply in selection of books about Africa for teenagers and for children. I would like to call your attention to two lists that you may not have known about. The New York Public Library has just published a list called Africa. And at the back of the list, those of you who are interested in children will find a list of new books for children on the very back page. If you work with young adults, the Books for the Teenage 1961, which is published by the New York Public Library, also has a section on Africa. And I think that I could stand behind most of the books that are on this list. I might add that 10 years ago when I started working with the library, the only thing that was on the Africa section of this list were the big game hunting books. And we've got some books about people at last.
Is it all right if I sit down? I have been sitting here and I've been thinking about, first of all, I have to correct something that the chairman said. I am here somewhat on false pretenses, because it is not only in African history or books on Africa that I've worked in the last few years. My interest stems out of the fact that I was a teacher at the Little Red Schoolhouse, a fifth grade teacher, where our curriculum was Negro history. And so out of the research that I did over many years, a Negro history came my interest also and necessarily in African history, so that I wrote a Negro history for children, which is unpublished. And I wrote, the first book that I wrote that was published is Corey and the Yankee, which is a book about a slave girl who helps a Union soldier to escape, to get back to his lines after being a prisoner of war. The book about Africa, I think, to which you were referring, is named Caravan from Timbuktu. I think there's a mistake in the program. It's from Timbuktu, and the spelling is T-I-M-B-U-K-T-U. Of course, I relish the chance to repeat this as many times as I can, because having been a teacher for many years, of course, I know the value of repetition. Now, about Caravan from Timbuktu, of course, I now feel so small in this seat that I wonder that anyone can see me, because I feel now that I can hardly remember where I got the presumption to write a book about Africa. And I say that, you know, only for myself, really. I agree with your point. I agree with the points of all the speakers.
I'd like to clarify that I think that the people who are interested can do research, et cetera, and
yeah,
so on. That still makes them qualified.
Well, and I would like to add that I welcome your investigation of the Caravan from Timbuktu to see about it. Of course, as I say, this did take many years of research, not only in Negro history, but the story of these early civilizations, in this case a medieval civilization in Africa, kept whirling around in my mind. And as soon as I finished Corey, I knew that somehow or other I would have to set it down, and I started some research on that period. I say some research because I guess there really isn't any way to measure the amount or the type of research that is necessary. I know that a lot of people look with rather raised eyebrows at anyone who writes juvenile, who does any research beyond just a mere reflection of, let's say, getting the facts, because as they say, well, it's for children, you just don't have to be so particular. But all of us who have taught, and all of us who have read, and all of us who know anything about it, know that it's just because it's for children that you really have to be most particular. I wrote about this 14th century civilization, and I found that when I discussed it with people, I found a great deal of surprise when I said that this was a most advanced civilization. At a time, let's say, in Europe, when Edward II of England was having all sorts of intrigues and the broken kingdoms and the various types of things of which we look back now, and we don't like to call it Western civilization. But the civilization in the kingdom of Mali, or Mali as it's sometimes transliterated, was a considerable one. I find the surprise to be, I suppose, what has come to be, more or less to you, a typically American reaction, you know, a surprise that any such thing could have existed. And many people think that I made it up out of whole cloth. But it is there, of course, to be found. And it's an exciting and splendid period. So that even though I was not there, either at the time or the place, I feel that fiction also has the opportunity, or rather than the necessity, to be more or less of a composite of what was and what is. And you have certain responsibilities along those lines. And so with these good intentions and with backed by years and years of intensive research, I just offer the book, and I can only hope for the best. Now, I have to sort of put on another hat, you see. I'm also here as a teacher. Although I'm out of the classroom now, I feel somehow or other teacher, I guess I feel a little bit more comfortable. It's an older hat. I've worn it a long time. It seems to fit me. The one of author is a little bit strange yet. And yet it's the
it's
same.
It's not as expensive a hat, though, is it?
We don't speak about money when we talk about either teachers or authors, do we? I wanted to talk about some of the things, you know, we've heard so much this afternoon that I'm sure, is my case, my head is just whirling. And yet when we realize what it is that we've heard,